Welcome to the Frontline Herbalism Podcast with your host Nicole Rose from the Solidarity Apothecary. This is your place for all things plants and liberation. Let's get started.
Hello, welcome back to the Frontline Herbalism Podcast. So this episode today is a kind of introduction to state repression from my own experiences and sharing my story of repression from which is like written in the Herbalism and State Violence book. And, you know, I say this at the end of the episode, but I just want to say it at the beginning that like this is, you know, my own unique context in the sense of like being a white person in England and Wales, and being a cis woman and yeah, being active in a kind of like social movement. It's not talking about repression in terms of like daily state violence, like the, you know, classism and racism and the border regime and like all the other things that I talk about and are in the Herbalism and State Violence book. Like this sort of section focuses specifically on repression as like a tactic to stop movements achieving, you know, kind of liberatory goals. And yeah, so I just want to premise that it's my own experience. And I know that might be like alienating to some people. Well, I'm sure to lots of people, but I know that other people like from, you know, maybe who are from the UK, for example, or have a similar background to me might find it kind of, yeah, validating, or you might feel some resonance. And yeah, just that like the state is violent in all forms, like all over the world, whether that's torturing prisoners in Belarus or sexually assaulting prisoners in Palestine, you know, like there's just like no end to the violence of the state and like multiple different forms of repression. And yeah, this is just like one little context, which yeah. Anyway, that's my disclaimer. And yeah, just I guess like content warning, I do talk about all the things. Well, I kind of briefly touch on all the things, but I don't explicitly go into prison very much, but I talk about, you know, arrests and raids and things like that. So anyway, thank you for listening. Please don't forget to check out the Hawthorne offering that is open for application for another week. Actually, check that before you, because I'm not 100% sure when I can publish this, but it's open from the 6th of, it's, the applications close from the 6th of August. So please get your applications in before then. And I can see my baby coming up the path. So I better go. But yeah, thank you for listening. Okay, so this is the introduction to state repression from the Herbalism and State Violence book. And it starts with a quote from the book Nietzsche and Anarchy, Psychology for Free Spirits, Ontology for Social War by Shahin. And it says, whenever we seriously threaten the state and capital, they will turn on us with extreme force. From the outset, we need to build the capacity and skills for combat. To support our struggle and to support life, we need to create our networks of care. In this section of the book, I give some insight into some of the tactics of state repression and where herbal solidarity is an option to support people's bodies and nervous systems as they endure and try to resist whatever the state has in store for them. One definition of repression is that it is the process by which, and this is in quotes, the dominant hegemonic order attempts to maintain power by destroying, rendering harmless, or appeasing those organizations, people, groups, or ideologies that potentially threaten their position of power or privilege. Hegemonic, in simple terms, means the powers that have dominance. For anyone involved in any kind of social struggle, you will see state repression in practice. Heavy policing on demonstrations, character assassination in the media, lengthy court cases and prison sentences, new laws and legislation to criminalise whatever campaign is in the headlines. As with all subjects covered in this book, how this violence is distributed is racialised, classed and gendered and intersects with all other forms of oppression. State repression also operates to different extents and with different state tactics around the world. In Russia, political dissidents may be hung upside down and tortured with cattle prods. In Iran, women organizers may be raped and burned by police and their proxies. In Mexico, people may be murdered and disappeared. In Spain, people may be imprisoned far from their families for decades. Wherever there is a state or a group of people trying to maintain power through force, they will respond with violence and repression whenever that power is threatened. Unfortunately, many social movements commonly have a kind of amnesia, not learning from history or remembering the generations before them that suffered repression at the hands of the state. Anyone organising for social change needs to be versed in the tactics of repression in whatever territory they live and organise in. For someone involved in anti-repression work, I regularly see groups and campaigns fall by the wayside, almost shocked that they've been arrested or that the state have been planning operations against them. Even if you use quote-unquote legal tactics or quote-unquote peaceful protests, if you threaten power in any way, you will attract repression. Therefore, developing infrastructure is vital, whether this is a local anarchist Black Cross chapter that can support people in prison, or groups offering Know Your Rights training for street actions, security culture guidance, computer security, or media training. Anti-repression action comes in many forms and can build movements with greater resilience to inevitable state repression. Okay, so my experiences of repression. Growing up in a very macho animal liberation movement, it was extremely taboo to talk about the social, emotional, or bodily impacts of repression. Whatever we were going through was nothing compared to the animals. And showing we were somehow being harmed was like awarding the state with a victory. Yet over the years, I saw the shock and impact of years of ongoing repression take its toll on even the most dedicated and defiant of organisers. The state effectively crushed our campaign to close down Europe's largest animal testing company. I learned that a small group of people can achieve a lot, but ultimately we will always come up against the power of the state. This is why I'm an anarchist. I know that it will take an entire social revolution to challenge that kind of state power. Individuals, targeted campaigns and collectives can be crushed, but whole movements or entire populations of resistance are harder to break. Likewise, the commitment and vision of liberation remains strong in people's hearts despite many decades of state repression. My own experiences would have been radically different with organised political and social support. Now that I'm organising support for others, it amazes me that I went through most of the repression I experienced alone, especially before prison. No one collected me at the police station, no one organised a support group, no fundraising or donations after my livelihood and home were smashed to bits. No help with understanding all the legal paperwork, no political solidarity, instead the opposite. A lot of hostility that our campaign had attracted the repression and we were, through our militancy, to blame. Lack of support is a common dynamic that makes experiences more traumatising. So what happened? Back in the 1980s and the 1990s and 2000s, the animal liberation movement in the UK was thriving. Breeders of laboratory animals were being shut down left, right and centre through grassroots campaigns and direct action. People were sabotaging fox hunts en masse. The fur industry was destroyed through raids. The animal liberation front was in full effect. It was accepted that prison was inevitable for people in the movement, and many people moved in and out of prison on generally shorter, although sometimes longer, sentences. It felt like power was on our side somehow. The police and the state couldn't keep up with this wild grassroots movement and the phenomenal public support behind it. I started my first animal rights group when I was 10 years old at school. I spent my weekends scrambling my bus fare together from my paper round to get to Bristol, the nearest city, and get a lift to local and national demonstrations. I saw people tear down fences on demos, police charge at us on horses, and friends have their ribs cracked by police attacks right in front of my eyes. As I grew up and policing became heavier, I saw tactics change to shorter and faster mobile demos and more covering up of faces and anonymity. Above ground actions were being pushed into a more underground style and the security risks blurred between them. By the time I was 16 years old, my first boyfriend went to prison after a home demonstration. At 17 years old, my next boyfriend was sentenced to a year for a fray after an altercation with some fox hunters. It became absolute normality for friends and loved ones to be in prison, and prison visits, calls and letter writing became a regular part of my week. I got my own house raided for the first time at 17, laughing it off as part of the macho environment the movement raised me in. When I was just 19 years old, the police smashed through my door on the quote-unquote big charge. In May 2007, the police raided more than 32 houses in an operation that targeted Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty, the grassroots campaign to close down Huntington Life Sciences. This is Europe's largest animal testing company that murdered over 200,000 animals every year. This was one chapter in a wave of organised state repression that lasted over 10 years. The charge was conspiracy to blackmail, which means making unwarranted demands with the threat of menaces. The premise of the charge was that because HLS is a legal company, our demands for people to cease trading with them were quote unquote unwarranted. And the menaces were the tactics we were using that included phone calls and emails to demonstrations to property damage. On a personal level, the police destroyed the house my ex and I were renting in the valleys of South Wales, smashing up the banister, breaking the bath, pulling up the carpets. The landlord saw us on TV and kicked us out. I came out of the police station alone while my ex was held for longer and found that our foster dog hadn't been taken into kennels like the police said they were due, and instead he was left alone in the kitchen with no food or water, shaking when I found him. His response to loud noises, his changed temperament and tendency to cower and shake for months afterwards taught me a lesson in traumatic stress and how non-human animals can show us the impact of an experience more obviously than we can observe it in ourselves. Three others were directly remanded to prison, while the rest of the group had strict bail conditions, not allowing us to speak to our friends, publish content on the internet, and all kinds of other legalistic restrictions. Court dates were constantly pushed back over and over again, leading to constant uncertainty and stress. 2 years of court hearings ensued, then finally a major trial where everyone was found guilty of conspiracy to blackmail. The state got what they wanted. Eventually, 12 of us were in prison, with the longer sentence being 11 years. I received 3.5. As I share more in the prison section of this book, I went to prison as a 21-year-old and served just under 2 years in total. Despite many people in the movement saying we should quote unquote treat prison like a holiday, in all honesty, it was violent and traumatizing and one of the most dehumanizing experiences of my life. But the repression was not over on release from prison. In England, you have a license, which means if you are released early from prison, generally kind of halfway through your sentence, but it's not guaranteed and it depends on the length and type of your sentence, you will have a set of conditions you have to adhere to. Otherwise, you will get recalled back to prison. These conditions vary from living at a certain address to not having intimate relationships without permission. Due to the political nature of our case, I had a ream of conditions about not interacting with anyone concerned with animal welfare. Overnight, I was not allowed to speak to nearly all of my friends for fear of going back to prison, and this lasted for nearly 2 years. The loneliness was designed to make us quote-unquote pro-social again and disconnect us from political struggles. It was incredibly effective at ensuring most people in the case did not return to grassroots organising. We were also given ASBOs, antisocial behaviour orders, a repressive mechanism developed to target working class communities to restrict their antisocial behaviour, such as drinking in parks. In our case, if we campaigned around vivisection again, we would face up to 5 years in prison. Three people from the campaign were given lifelong ASBOs. This ASBO was triggered when we were released from prison, which meant by the time it was over, we had been living with these restrictions for over a decade, where returning to prison had been constantly over our heads. The many tactics of state repression. It wasn't until somehow we emerged from the personal fallout of repression that it became possible to really grasp the bigger picture of what had been happening in the movement. We were on the crest of a wave of intensified repression. It wasn't just the mass arrests, house raids, prison sentences, or physical violence on demonstrations and mass policing efforts. We'd learned that the state had spent 2.1 million on the operation to end the campaign, including putting 12 of us under surveillance for nearly 2 years beforehand. The murky world of undercover informants, relationship sabotage, and media slander also came to light. New legislation specifically targeting campaigns against animal testing had been enacted in law, which would be used to later target groups that dared to still challenge vivisection. An entire police unit, the National Extremism Tactical Coordination Unit, NETCU, had been developed specifically to influence the media with press releases documenting the campaign in an effort to persuade the public that our actions were rooted in quote-unquote extremism and terrorism. The personal impacts of repression. And this is from a book called Os Caniceros, A Crime Called Freedom. Sorry if I've pronounced that wrong. It's a really amazing book, by the way. The state treats delinquents en masse as a social danger, but demolishes them one by one. In my Herbalism, PTSD and Traumatic Stress course, there is a module all about trauma and common trauma dynamics. These explore what can make an experience particularly traumatizing or more traumatizing. Loneliness, isolation, and lack of support are some of the largest factors. Through repression, it was the lack of support that carried the biggest weight for me. I felt betrayed, lost, and alone. There was no one at the police station waiting for me on release. There was no organized support group that could help with fundraising or actions outside the court. Living on benefits without a safety net or a family with money meant that every time there was a court appearance, it was literally a choice between travel expenses and eating that week. It was enormously stressful to manage the fear and anxiety of thinking I was going to get 12 years in prison, which was the sentence others had received in a previous blackmail case. I left home at 16 and didn't finish formal education or A-levels at college. I'm also dyslexic and legal work feels incredibly intimidating. I had no idea how to approach the folders and boxes worth of case papers and legal paperwork. I didn't know what to advocate for with the solicitors or how the whole thing worked. People told us they were scared to be associated with us. They were afraid to be pulled into the web of repression. This is why no one called to check if my partner or I were okay. The feeling of betrayal still flows through me, and it's hard to feel any political affinity with the animal liberation movement after these experiences. People blamed us for bringing the repression on ourselves, that we went too far, that it was our fault that the whole movement had been impacted. Even within the group of defendants, we were legally disallowed from communicating with each other, which compounded the isolation and led to dirty tactics, like defendants distancing themselves from you to achieve shorter sentences. Overall, it was a shit show. And what did this all create? It led to the destruction of many relationships. It highly impacted my nervous system, leading to years of constant fight or flight and activation that was hard to unravel. Prison itself caused me to develop PTSD and being haunted by nightmares and intrusive thoughts and flashbacks for many years before being able to access treatment and support. I developed chronic health issues and a vivid understanding of how trauma shapes the body. These experiences were all on top of a very challenging childhood with many of the trauma dynamics repeating themselves. Ultimately, it created a feeling of loneliness and alienation socially, emotionally, and politically for many years before I was able to process, integrate, and heal from these experiences, mostly by throwing myself into anti-repression efforts to make sure no one felt alone like I and others had at the time. The movement effects of repression. While I often speak about the importance of anti-repression work because of the traumatic impacts of repression and on the individual, a bigger purpose to it all is because repression takes its toll on what we are trying to achieve as movements. In our case, it meant that the murderous vicinity that was HLS remained open and the animals continued to be tortured. For other campaigns, it may mean that sacred mountains get destroyed, prisons get built, or people get deported. Whatever we are fighting for, repression aims to render us ineffective. It aims to not only prevent groups from achieving their goals, but commonly carries the aim to completely destroy or end groups, campaigns, and movements. In our case, we later learned the police called it leadership decapitation. They wanted to cut the head off our movement, which tells you something about the violence of their actions. Repression creates a broad culture of fear and can commonly lead to the pacification of movement tactics. For example, this may involve the co-option of militant tactics and radical visions for change into more legalistic forms of organising. This may involve funneling energy into parliamentary quote-unquote democracy and lobbying, or even the focus on consumer choices and corporate relationships, as happened with radical veganism, which was once very intersectional and focused on direct action and eventually evolved into green capitalism, whereby the focus is less on what we do and more on what we buy. Energies may also be co-opted into what is known as the not-for-profit industrial complex. The group Insight, Women of Colour Against Violence, published the book The Revolution Will Not Be Funded in 2017, exploring the not-for-profit industrial complex and how political goals are often co-opted to serve movement, to serve government, grant-making and foundation interests. Instead of building movements, the focus shifts to building NGOs. I'd highly encourage anyone involved in social change work of different kinds to read the book and explore these tensions. Likewise, repression leads to the destruction of relationships and loss of comrades. People step back from organising either through fear or lack of support. They burn out and drop out, disappearing from movements due to trauma and chronic health issues and a general lack of collective care. We can never build powerful movements for change if we fail to take care of each other and leave people behind. Herbalism is a beautiful offering to help tend to people's frightened hearts, exhausted bodies, and fractured spirits when they are enduring repression. This is what this part of the book explores. And this is what this podcast series explores. So yeah, that's just like a general little introduction to my experiences of repression. And, you know, I put in a lot of disclaimers at the beginning of the Herbalism and State Violence book about privilege and class and whiteness and how I'm operating in like a very specific context, which, you know, is still valid and will resonate with a lot of people, like from England and Wales, for example, or the so-called US. But yeah, this repression is really talking about like movements for liberation, and it's not talking about just like the unrelenting violence, right, in the world where that is inflicted by the state. So anyway, I just wanted to give that little extra disclaimer. Thank you so much for listening.
Thanks so much for listening to the Frontline Herbalism podcast. You can find the transcript, the links, all the resources from the show at solidarityapothecary.org/podcast.